So what I was going to do the last time, which should only take a few minutes, I say that every time, is I would introduce these rate equations. And then I wanted to show that sort of entropy can be used to prove that the rate equation dynamics monotonically approach their fixed point. And part, the reason I want to do this is because what's going to happen is in game theory, very similar things going to happen, but the, the restrictions on the games for this to happen are going to be really very stringent. And so part of it is to, so you can sort of see what the variety games are that don't do what you expect, you know, that there's no theorem that will tell you that they will monotonically approach steady state. Okay, so that's sort of the point of this, is this is sort of brand X, so that when I do the games, you can sort of see that there's very little brand X. Okay, that's why I thought it was worth bringing up. Okay, so I wrote these equations down last time. Haven't yet put the entropy in, but I will today. Okay. And again, the JIJs are transition rates. Okay. And it's a transition from J to I. Okay. And these are quite restrictive dynamics. But they do have the property that the JIJs can be, the JIJs have to be, real and greater than or equal to zero. But there's no symmetry requirement, and so if you make a transition rate matrix, so all the entries are real and positive, but there's no, it's not a Hermitian matrix, and, sort of a priori, you don't know for sure their eigenvalues, and so in that sense, it's quite general. And again, they don't depend, the transition rates don't depend on the P's. Okay, and so it's a linear equation for that. Okay, and that's why everything is so nice. Okay, and again, this question came up last time is that you don't have to make any restrictions on the J's, and in particular, if you put in a diagonal term, a JII, just the form of the equation will guarantee that that there's no this is a J, this is a sorry, it guarantees that there's no term. Yeah. Say that again.
The definition of JIJ.
Yes.
The transition from I to J or J to I.
Okay, well, you can sort of, I do it by looking at the equation. So the interpretation is, okay, if state J is occupied, okay, if it's not occupied, then your chances of leaving it are zero just because of what you weren't there to begin with, okay? So this says that I was in state J, okay, and then I made a transition to state I. So it's from J to I. Okay, but again, it's like completely confusing in the sense that you know, it's a matter of pure convention and people pick the conventions differently. But the way you can decide is just by looking at this subscript. Okay, this subscript is saying, the state is occupied at the moment. And you don't make the transition out of it unless it's occupied at the moment. Okay?
I'm saying it's based on that minus sign. If that's the case, then the minus sign should be reversed. Because if you're moving from J to I, then you have to reduce to the rate at which the P I changes.
No, but this is, okay, you're changing P I. Yeah. Okay? So you're going from J to I. So you're putting more stuff in I. Mm-hmm. Okay? And here, you're going from I to J, and so then you're removing stuff from I and putting it into J. Okay, so believe it or not, this one is not a typo. This one is correct. Okay. All right. So okay. And so it turns out that you can prove. Okay. And so again, the thing that makes this not entirely trivial. I mean, because it's a linear equation, but it's not entirely trivial because again, it's a matrix, and the matrix is sort of not completely arbitrary, but you know, quite general. And so, so one thing that is true, which is the proof is extremely dull and has nothing to do with entropy, so I decided to skip it, is that there is a steady state, okay, that at long times, okay, you put the Bell-Lee thermodynamics long enough and you hit a steady state. And the steady state has the property that Pj is equal to zero, okay, where Wij is equal to Jij minus delta Ij, somewhere Ji. Okay, and now what this is, again, it's just popping. You know, this is just a more compact way of writing this thing where the left hand side is zero. Okay, so there is a steady state distribution. Okay, now there's a subset of graphs. So again, you can think of this as transition between nodes of a graph. And if you make your graph have constant degree, I think that's sufficient. But okay, but there are graphs for which the steady state distribution is a constant, but more general graphs, if you have a lot of stuff coming in, you'll have higher density. And so the theorem that you can prove is works for any steady state distribution, but requires a slight generalization of the entropy in order to do that. So I figured I'd do the more general case and then introduce this little generalization of the entropy. Okay, and part of it is just so you, that you know that this entropy business, there are all sorts of different measures of information in entropy and which are useful in different in contexts. Okay, so what I'm going to prove in the end, okay, and again, it's not too complicated, is that any dynamics, so there is a steady state, okay, I'm not going to prove, but I am going to prove that you converge to the steady state for any transition rate dynamics, and the way I'm going to prove that is by introducing a thing called the Kullback-Leibler relative entropy. Okay, and this reduces to regular Shannon entropy in the limit that the steady state was uniformly, all the PIs were the same. Okay, but I'm doing the slightly more general case because it's not very much harder and it's more general. Okay, so let me just do that. So you have two, so the point about it is that you have two probability distributions. Okay, so what I talked about last time, I had one probability distribution, and I wanted to know the information in that one probability distribution. Well, here I'm comparing two different ones, all right? And it turns out this thing has some problems, okay? But you'll see that it's useful, but it's not as wonderful as one would like, but it's sort of the most, in some sense, the most natural thing you can do, okay? So it's called D by some people. The notes I took from called it D. Okay, so what I've got is I'm cooking up a number that's describing something to do with the relative entropy of two distributions, one of which I'm going to call rho, and one of which I'm going to call rho prime. Okay, and it's just defined as rho k log of rho k divided by rho k prime. Okay, and you can sort of see the similarity to Shannon entropy, and it's a slight generalization of Shannon entropy because suppose I pick, if I choose rho k to equal rho k prime is equal to the uniform distribution, with n possibilities. Okay, then this thing is it's a sum over k rho k log rho k minus sum over k rho k log 1 over n, okay? But now this just sums to 1, so it's just equal to log n minus sum of, oops, there's the n, rho k, little n, sorry, log n minus rho k log
We're okay. Okay. And I dropped the constant. So I'm not going to mess up the constant because I dropped it. Okay. So so the point is, and this is the Shannon entropy. Okay. So if you're comparing the probability distribution to a uniform one, then this thing reduces to the Shannon entropy. But this is a way where you can compare two different probability distributions. Okay. And it has the very nice property that if the two distributions are different, okay, prime is greater than or equal to zero. Okay, if the two probability distributions are different, then this thing is positive. Okay, it's positive definite, and it's equal to zero only when the two probability distributions are the same. So I put the proof in the notes, but basically, it's again one of these proofs that has nothing. Well, I'll tell you what. The only thing that goes in it is that you're looking at the log function. Okay, so the log function looks sort of like this. Okay, and it has a property that it's concave downward, and so what you do is if you have something that's concave downward, then it turns out that you can replace the log. The log of the average is less than or equal to the average of the log. Okay, and so because of that, it turns out that's enough to prove that this is true. Okay, so it's not so informative, but it's just because logs are concave. All right, and so anyway, and so this is the thing which is nice because we're going to basically just plug into this equation. And what we're going to find is that the dynamics of this, the transition rate dynamics, can be related to this thing. And this thing's positive definite. And so d by dt is equal to, you know, is sort of the d by dt of this thing is greater than or equal to zero, which means then, less than or equal to zero. And so basically it just goes until this thing hits zero and then it stops. Okay, and so so in dynamics, this thing's called a thing that basically monotonically increases as the system evolves. It's called a Lyapunov functional. But for these kinds of dynamics, it turns out that entropy, this relative entropy, is a Lyapunov functional. Okay, so I told you everything good about this relative entropy, and the good things about it are enough that it's, you know, it's perfectly good for what we need. And again, in this very restricted game theory case, it's going to be the same function. What's bad about it is that you want it to be the distance between these distributions. Okay, is that a question or yeah? Okay.
Does this relative entropy then require that the two distributions be over the same number of events?
So let me say this about that, as they say. Typically, it's sort of two distributions on the same process. But there is this question of how do you going to the continuum limit, which I have completely sidestepped. Okay, turns out that for Shannon entropy, that's non-trivial. Okay, and there are various things that are true with Shannon entropy for finite but large number of bits that when you take the continuum limit don't hold still because of, again, the things that happen in the continuum limit. But actually, one of the things that people like about this is that it is, you can take the continuum limit because basically you have sort of the same process and then you're looking at two different probability distributions over the same thing, and then basically, you know, you sort of define what you mean by the continuum limit on both things at the same time. And so the continuum limit turns out to be much better controlled for relative entropy than for Shannon entropy. So in that sense, it's more robust. But it's, again, often, you know, if you have something where the limit is sort of problematic, if you sort of subtract two quantities where you're taking the limit in both, often, you know, the difference is better, you know, is well defined, even if each individual one is not, as you know. I mean, that's sort of, again, you know, these fundamental things, normalization, right, where you just take differences and then the differences are what you measure. So, right. So basically, again, in this transition rate dynamics, as always, for me, I always like to have something in particular in mind. Here, again, I've got a bunch of states. I just have a list of a bunch of states. And a complete characterization of the system is to just say, well, the problem, you know, I have states 1 through n. And I just say, well, the probability I'm in state one is P1, and the probability I'm in state two is P2, okay? And so your distribution is just the list of the P's, okay? And so then I say, well, I have one set of P's, and that's one probability distribution, and then I have another set of P's, and that's another probability distribution. So in these dynamics, it's very sort of natural. It's just the list of all the probabilities of all the states, okay? And then there's a configuration that you might get to, you know, if you imagine just sort of simulating it in a Lagrangian kind of way, where, you know, you start off with a particle somewhere, and then you know, a bunch of particles not interacting, and then you just make transitions between them and ask, you know, how many particles are on each site at long times. Okay, so it's very natural there, okay? All right, and so now what I want to do is show you that knowing this, defining this thing, then tells you that the dynamics will converge to the steady state. Okay, so that's what you came. Yeah.
I did actually have one other question.
Okay.
Is this relative entropy symmetric in the two distributions?
No, and that's right. I interrupted myself. That's the problem with it. Is that you want it to be? You somehow want it to be to say, oh, it's a measure of the distance between them, but it's not symmetric, and it doesn't satisfy the triangle inequality either. Okay, so it does have this nice property that if the distributions are the same, it's always positive and it never goes negative, but it's not a distance, and that sort of limits, you know, what it's good for. So it's good for us because we need this, and we don't actually need it to be a distance. Because, you know, our probability distributions are not symmetric, right? That we're going to do, we're going to compare our probability distribution to time t to the steady state one. And the steady state one has a special set, so we don't care that it's not symmetric. But in general, it's not always what you need because it's not symmetric. Okay. It comes up all the time. Again, it sounds like it's very special, but it turns out this comes up in lots of different contexts. So I have no guilt. At watching you do this. Okay, so are there any other questions about that? Because now the rest of this business is, you know, basically to show you that this equation for the dynamics implies that this thing is always increasing. Okay, that's you know, and so, and then if that thing's always increasing, then you know, it's always increasing so long as this is not the distribution that you've got is not the equilibrium one, and that the only way for it to stop evolving is to hit equilibrium, right? So that sort of guarantees for you that you reach equilibrium. Not only do you monotonically approach it, but you actually get there. So, so let me just run through that. Okay, so again, what I'm doing is I'm going to say that, you know, for transition rate dynamics, d by dt of d, I'm just going to do this, p prime is less than or equal to 0, where p prime is equal to p. Well, actually, let me just put in p bar. Okay. So again, this just says that this the relative entropy just monotonically decreases, and the difference monotonically decreases and equals zero only when p is equal to p bar. Okay, so then it stops evolving only when you hit equilibrium. Okay, so so how do you do this? And again, it's all very natural, and you know, in all these contexts, I mean, this comes in. You put in everything you know, right? So here we're going to do p bar, okay? And you just take d by dt of, pk1 pk divided by pk prime, okay? And, but this we know how to do, right? Because we've got an equation for the time derivative of the p's. So it's just a matter of plugging in and going, okay? And again, so the only reason you knew to do this at some level is
sort of, you know that somehow entropy is a good thing, so why don't we try it, if you see what I mean. But once you know that entropy is a good thing, the showing that it works is, you know, just a matter of plugging and chugging, okay? So I will let you vote. I mean, do you want me to go through this? I mean, there are a few things, but it's in the notes. I mean, all the okay, so I'm not going to plug and chug it. But what happens is then you do this, and it is, you get to a certain point. You get it up to here, okay? And again, you just, you take this thing, you plug it in there, and then you end up with ij, pj, log, pi, pj, divided by pi bar pj, okay? And that's mathematical identities, okay? Then you do have to use this convexity thing. Somehow this seems to be very popular in these things, okay? And then this turns out to be less than or equal to, again, just because of the convexity, pij, pj, times just the quantity, pi, p bar j, pi bar pj, okay? And this, you manipulate some more, and that turns out to be zero, okay? And so this is equal to zero, okay? So it's less than or equal to zero, okay? And so that's, okay, and then you can go back and wend your way through the derivation, and when you do that, you can also prove that it's equal only if all the p's are equal to the p bar, okay? You know, again, you wend your way through, and I did it in the notes, and so, again, watching me do algebra is particular. It's not boring because you have no idea what I'm going to screw up, but it's maybe not so illuminating, okay? So that was what I was going to say about why entropy is a good thing. Okay, again, that there is this pretty big class of systems where, you know, once you know about entropy, it's sort of a thing to try as a Lyapunov functional. Again, something that dynamics preserves. No, there's a log here. There's a log. And so that's, and again, it's because of this. Okay, yeah.
What's the last line? Could you just read it?
Less than or equal to zero. It turns out then you work on that thing some more, and it's zero.
So it's jij.
Pj, then there's pi, pj bar, pi bar, pj. Okay.
And the p bars are the steady
state. The p bars are the steady state for p's. Okay.
So it seems like, this might be really silly, I'm probably missing something, but it seems like that's a sum of a bunch of positive terms.
No. Wait, okay, so let me go through. And again, I think I did in the notes. If not, I could refer you to the original paper where this is all worked out. It's the, I think I put it in the references. It's in a footnote. It's the Revmont-Fitz article, the Schnackenbergs. Okay, so according to this, I mean, basically what happens is, The what happens, see, the Jij's, wait, what happened? Yeah, I see your point. Jij, Pj's, oh, I'm sorry, wait, no, Jij, Pj, Pi, Pj bar, Pi, Pj bar, the last quality forms. I see your point. I think what happened is, okay, I have to go back. You had to subtract, when you end up doing this, you end up actually using the trick of you got to subtract off the diagonal term. So the Jij start off positive, but I think between this step and that step, I have to, you got to change your Jij so that they have essentially to these W's, which have been zero. Okay. So, again, there is a. It's a good thing I didn't work through more of it because that's what happened. So again, when you do this, you subtract off a term that causes everything to be zero, and then.
So basically, the J's don't have any positive in
that. Right, and it's
you start off with these j's that are positive, but then again, then you just change them, so the mean is zero, and then when you do that, then you're golden. That's what happens. But naturally, I do it. It's there are equations in the notes that are guaranteed to be right because they're stolen from here, and then I put in additional steps. Some of them are missing pieces. Okay, so that's what happens. Okay, so basically, at this point, here is when he went. So let me just. Okay, at this point, here you see I equals j. The I equals j term is explicitly zero because log of pi pi bar divided by. Okay, it's zero here. So at this point in the equation, you subtract off the mean. Okay, and then you get to that, and that's how. And then it's zero. Okay, but you have to at this point. So. All right, so it turns out this is actually a W, and that's why it works. Sorry about that. Okay, but you see here, this is all good, and then you subtract off the mean, and then the rest. Sorry about that. Okay, so that was what I want to say about the entropy, and again, partly because it's one of the few methods that we have for proving. Again, in this restricted class of games that converge, it's a method that you use, and it's also a very generally handy thing, so I wanted to tell you about it. Just so you know, it turns out that the class of games for which you can prove everything converges nicely to equilibrium turns out to be the games where everybody gets the same payoff, so everybody wants the same thing. Okay, so. So it turns out that you could, you know, if you, in terms of these transition rate dynamics, it seems, you know, pretty general, okay? But games, it turns out, the regime of games that turn out where this type of argument works is extremely small, okay? And actually, that's why I decided that, you know, looking at games is interesting, is because, again, the regime of things, the subset of games that actually nicely, you know, if you put on natural dynamics and nicely go to equilibrium, is extremely unrepresentative. Okay, which means, of course, that everything else is up for grabs. So that's the point that the mathematical techniques we have to show that things reach steady state when we apply them to the dynamics characteristic of games, they sort of tell us, well, hitting steady state is really, really not so typical. Okay, and then again, what happens is that people don't know what to do if you don't hit steady state, so mostly we look at games that hit steady state. So I think there's, you know, sort of a lot of white space. Okay, so now I'm ready, finally, to start on the games, okay? And okay. So probably what I'm going to do, okay, before I do that, I'll just say, are there any questions about anything so far? Okay, because now, again, we're going to do something which looks completely different. Again, hopefully by the end, everything will be tied together into a beautiful, intellectually cohesive package, but don't bank on it, okay? All right, so let me tell you a little bit about game theory, and actually, it was invented by John von Neumann, who is the same John von Neumann who developed the von Neumann entropy and who developed the von Neumann architecture for computers. And he did lots of other things, too. And he wrote a book in I think it was published in 1944. He's working on this sort of through the 30s, I guess. Quantum mechanics, sort of being a major player in quantum mechanics and being a major player in the invention of the computer was not really sufficient for him, and he was bored. And so he got interested in economics. And he wrote this book, which again, the notes will be, there'll be some notes on Monday. Again, there will be fewer typos than there are in the notes at the moment by Monday, but caveat emptor on the typos, okay? Everything's referred to here. So, and it's very interesting to read this book, which I can't send you, but if you look on the internet, it's there,
okay, I'm sure it's there illegally, but, you know, so I can't possibly point you to it, but if you rummage around, somebody actually scanned in a library copy of this book in the internet. And you can find it, I'm sure. If I can find it, you can find it. Okay, so you don't even have to go buy it. All right, anyway, and so at the beginning of this book, he sort of talks about, you know, why I got interested in games. And basically, he makes the analogy to thermodynamics and statistical mechanics, where he said until the invention, and again, this is one of the reasons I sort of tortured you with the century business. He says, you know, until the invention of heat, of understanding what heat is and what entropy is, thermodynamics was not a quantitative science because people would do things and they'd measure the work done, and you know, and it depended on the path, and people didn't see how to quantify the study of engines. Okay, which. You know, and you could sort of see it in the 1800s where people would, if you didn't know what heat, you know, how to define heat and entropy and temperature, that you would just sort of say, well, I do this, what looks to be the same thing, and I get different answers, right? And okay, but then there was this sort of insight of that entropy existed as a quantity and that it enabled people to make a real mathematical theory of thermodynamics and then later statistical mechanics. And he said, well, okay, and so now we look at economic systems, we have that same thing where we don't think it can be quantified. But he sort of said, well, that may just be a failure of our tools as opposed to, you know, and again, and then just so you know, this is why I have spent, 25 years now, you know, looking into complex systems because this is the key question, okay? So it's very different than a lot of other realms of physics where the question is, you know, sort of, you know, somehow the mathematical program, we don't know how to do it, but we know what it is. Okay. Here we don't know what it is, okay, which I like that sort of thing. And all right. So the point is he says, well, you know, so the problem is just that, like, what can we understand mathematically? You know, some things are just too complicated, but other things, you know, are amenable to mathematical description. And he holds up thermodynamics as an example of something that seemed like it was not amenable to mathematical description, that once you figured out what the mathematical description was, it turned out it was. Okay. And again, and you may say, well, there's so many atoms and a gas, and you know, there are all the things that we now say about complex social systems. You can imagine saying about thermodynamic systems. And in fact, people did say them, but in retrospect, once the theory has been constructed, then you say, okay, all right. So he quite explicitly talks about this in his book and says, well, that was his goal. And so the goal of game theory was to sort of think about not systems that are governed by stupid dynamics. You know, I've got a particle, it has forces, it follows F equals ma. But rather, you're looking at the interactions of rational agents. So he's thinking very much trying to put social sciences on the same footing as physical science. I mean, that was his agenda, and so that was why, obviously, he thought this was an important thing to do in his spare time. And again, I have no idea what he thought was more important of the stuff that he did. Okay, so anyway, but he worked on this for you know, quite a while, and so he sort of developed game theory explicitly as, you know, trying to formulate the right mathematical formalism to describe economic systems. He's quite clear that he was focused on economic systems. And I think also this was like during the Great Depression, and you know, and you know, so he had a lot of, you know, interest in understanding this. And you know, and actually my interest for getting, you know, trying to learn about it is partly because, you know, sort of seeing instabilities in the economy, then you really do want to, you know, I wanted to know just for myself, like, you know, what this was all about. Okay, and so what happened is that, so he cooked up game theory, and he wrote this book, and sort of people worked on it for a little while, and in particular, the one of the important concepts in game theory is what's called Nash equilibrium, which I will tell you what it is. And that's basically you have the agents and everybody's trying to optimize their own utility. Okay. And again, if you read von Neumann's book, he goes on about, you know, how do you, you know, can you define utility? And he sort of says, well, yeah. Okay. So for what I'm going to do, I'm just going to assume that we can. And utility is basically, in terms of the consumer, it's like how much you're willing to spend on something, you know, or how much something is worth to you. Okay. And again, it's not completely clear there's one number, but once you've invented money, then this idea that you're willing to pay for something says, well, yeah, you probably do have, you know, some measure of utility. Okay. And so the point was, so basically everybody's trying to optimize their utility. And can you do this? And Nash's theorem says that there is always a Nash equilibrium, okay, which says that nobody has an incentive to change what they're doing. Because if they did, they wouldn't get any more utility than they're already getting, so why would they change? Okay. And the Nash's theorem proves that such an equilibrium exists. But it's a non-constructive proof. It's, you know, and you know, and so basically the trick is, how do you find Nash equilibrium? So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to do things that are essentially, you know, still in the von Neumann type thing, you know, sort of very basic concepts. And so we're going to, you know, compute Nash equilibria for some simple games. And they have non-intuitive properties. And so that's one of the big things I want to get across, is that when you do this thing with the rational agents, you think it may look rational, and according to the rules, what they do is rational, because it is a mathematical theory, but it's what rational agents do is sometimes counterproductive. And the reason why that is so is that because the agents are sort of looking for local optimization. So they say, given everybody else is doing what they're doing, I, you know, you do what's best, okay, for yourself, given that everybody else is doing what they're doing. But what that could mean is that the whole community is could be getting much, everyone could be getting much higher utility, but nobody gets it because everybody is optimizing locally, okay. And so that's thing number one, which again, in terms of, you know, concepts is very useful, and also in terms of understanding why these problems are hard. There's a thing called Pareto optimality. Okay, Pareto optimality is that everybody is getting as much utility as possible. Okay, and it turns out for very simple standard games, Pareto optimality is provably not a Nash equilibrium. Okay, so the great problem of the development of society is, how do you get from Nash optimality to Pareto optimality? Okay, and that's just, you know, again, we, you know, there's a lot of work on this in the sense of, you know, how do you design things so that, you know, people aren't as selfish as they could be. So anyway, so this is just an aside, but when I go through this, I sort of find it amazing, like sort of all these laissez-faire economists who are somehow claiming game theory is, you know, sort of evidence that we should, you know, not have any regulation. And I just find the whole thing extremely baffling. And so that's one of the reasons, you know, I feel it's worth discussing, because, you know, again, game theory tells you explicitly that, you know, laissez-faire can't possibly work, okay? And anyway, that's it. Anyway, so what happened to game theory, though, so Nash proved his theorem, and then people somehow thought, okay, well now we'll be able to mathematically sort of model things. But it turned out that there was a problem, which is, it turns out in practice, calculating Nash equilibria is quite difficult. And so sort of nothing much happened, but then later on, and not only that, there was this sort of problem of what's the right game, and how, you know, there was sort of a lack of a sense of how do you get to optimality? Okay, and so then in the around 1980, it started in the 70s, but it became more popular in the 80s. What happened was a population biologist pointed out that actually you do not need to have a rational agent to reach a Nash equilibrium. Okay, so he was doing models of population biology, and he pointed out that if you interpret utility, and you just, instead of calling it utility, you call it fitness of an organism, you're going to have a completely stupid organism. But if it happens to have higher fitness and the population goes up, then it turns out that, you know, you can map that onto a game, you know, that the mathematics is identical. And if that population goes to a steady state, that steady state has to be a Nash equilibrium. Okay. Now, it turns out the converse is not true, that you can have games with Nash equilibria that when you map onto dynamics, there is, you know, that doesn't reach a Nash equilibrium. And there are games where it's been proven and shown and whatever that, that the dynamics are chaotic. And it's not well understood when is it chaotic, when is it not chaotic. But what it means is that the rationality in the agents at least sometimes doesn't matter. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. Okay, so so that was a big development, and that particular development is the thing that connects this to dynamics. Because it turns out that in the evolutionary games, there's a very well-defined dynamics that naively you might have thought was similar to these transition rate dynamics, but turns out not, you know, to be much more complex. And sort of understanding the dynamics and, you know, relevant situations is still in progress. So that is a one line of very active investigation at the moment. There's another line of really active investigation at the moment, and the motivation for that line is quite different. And actually, it has to do with Google, because the way Google makes money, I mean, I guess you've noticed, like, you search and you don't pay. That's the triumph of Google. But Google sells ads, and Google makes, what, $50 billion a year? I mean, really a lot of money. Okay. And the way they make their money is they sell these ads. And the way they sell their ads is they have an auction. So every time you search in Google, they look at the thing, and there are people who have bid for your search, okay? And they decide how much they're willing to pay for placement as an ad on the Google page. Because you know how it is. There's on the Google, when it comes up, there's the sponsored links. Okay, that's how they make $50 billion a year through the sponsored links. Okay, and so the question is, Google wants to maximize the amount of money it's making. Okay, so Google is playing a game, okay? But their game is that they're offering this space to people, and then, you know, people decide how much they want to bid in order to have a certain placement, okay? And all right, and it turns out that that's extremely well described by game theory. Okay, it's a game, right? How much are you willing to bid, and other people are willing to bid, and, you know, so we can put in the, all right. But that kind, and it comes up in other things. Like, for instance, there was a big auction of the cellular spectrum. And again, there's the design of that auction. And again, this is all done using the tools of game theory. All right. And so the government wanted to optimize the amount of money it made in this auction. Okay. So anyway, so it turns out it's a huge business, because search is a very, very big business. And so the computer science community in the last, well, ever since Google, right, since Google started selling ads, so, you know, in the last 10 years, it's turned out this has become, a very big area of applied computer science. And again, it's moved into pure computer science. But there, the point of the auction, in particular if you think Google, is that there you're not just having, you know, Joe and Fred, you know, flipping coins, or you'll see all the games are, you know, matching pennies, or, you know, the two agents. But rather, in that situation, you're looking at a situation where you've got lots and lots of people playing the game. Okay, and in all the games I'm going to show you, we know the payoffs. Okay, we do this thing and we say, okay, if Fred does this and Harry does this, then, you know, Harry gets utility 1 and Fred gets utility 3, and everything I'm going to show you is like that. But in the internet context, what happens is that, you know, you have, you know, sort of, you know, I forget, like, per minute how many people search, but it's millions, clearly millions, okay? And then they have, you know, a lot of advertisers, and okay. And so the game, and so this idea that you're going to specify the payoff, it's going to be called the payoff matrix, that you're going to specify the payoff matrix for the game is clearly not feasible. I mean, you've got to do it where you play it, and it's some sort of sampling thing is done. And so again, the specification of the problem that we're going to do is inherently exponential when you have a large game. So the computer scientists are very focused on the question of, well, what do you do when the game is huge? Okay, and that's where this question of how hard is it to compute the Nash equilibrium, which is sort of, you know, where everybody is doing as well as they can do given what everyone else is doing. And again, it turns out that's a very hard problem. Based on like how long it took to do just the basics, I don't know if I'll get to it, but I wanted to point it out. And it's, there's this algorithmic game theory book, which again, I can't tell you the link, but if you look on the internet, it's there. Okay, so anyway, and so the point is that, so this question of, you know, how well can you do, and then the proof that it's, it seems to be, it is likely to be computationally intractable is then, you know, really a critical thing. Okay, and so then, but then this leads to an immediate, well, you know, there's sort of like the, there's the fundamental computer science view of, oh, it's intractable, but Google doesn't care, right? They say, well, it may be intractable, but we want to do the best we can. Okay, so how well can you do approximation schemes? But then also, this, as a physicist, leads to the thing of, well, what, you know, then, you know, can we understand, you know, sort of dynamics that you do, that you add to this process that you can do to do better or worse? Okay, so that's, those are open questions. So I'm telling you about this just because I think it's an interesting area, not because I can say, okay, you know, here is this accomplishment which, you know, is clearly important. But I think that these are questions that physicists have a lot, you know, have the potential to have a lot of impact in. And again, given that billions of dollars is being, you know, made, I mean, never mind being spent, but billions of dollars is being made on it every year, you know, there's sort of a societal drive or our business drive to understand some of these issues better than we do. And again, when there's such a huge amount of money involved, then, you know, even small increments in our understanding can have a big economic effect. Okay. So that's what I wanted to say to introduce game theory. And again, in terms of why it's dynamics, I'm going to focus on the evolutionary game theory aspect. But again, once you know that this idea of the rational agent sort of looking at all the options and picking the best one, the one that's most rational, is computationally intractable, then this dynamical approach becomes even more relevant and important. Because it says that this idea of like these really smart people figuring out the best thing to do is just not actually a model of economics. So in that sense, von Neumann was completely correct that this was a useful thing to do, because what we found out is that we falsified the model of rational agents doing the best thing. We know that that is not what happened. Well, I mean, we sort of knew it was what happened. You know, there's a famous unpublished paper by Larry Summers, who is sort of a famous economist, that starts, you know, there are idiots, look around. Okay, so, you know, but this sort of proves that even if you're not an idiot, you're still not going to be able to do this. Okay, and so that's why sort of understanding what the dynamics do is important. Okay, so I think what I'm going to do, since I managed to talk, except for the last couple of minutes, is I'm going to leave you with just an intro to the simplest kind of two-person game. So we're going to define a game. Okay, and I think I can do that in 2 minutes. Okay, so a game has players. How many players? N players. Okay, and what I'm going to do here, because I'm doing essentially just introduction, N's going to be mostly 2. But it's pretty easy to see where you can make N a bigger number. Okay, and then each player, and we'll call the player I, okay, has, in the notes, the player is called K. Because again, things will be bad enough without that. Okay, has S, has a set of strategies, okay, S sub K, okay, and there, that has MK strategies in it. Okay, So immediately you just define this thing called the strategy vector. Okay. All right. And so again, in
each person has a choice.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm the kth player. Okay. And let's say I can be boring. Well, no. Let me. You know, I can go left, right, or stay in the middle. Okay. So I've got three strategies. Okay. And then you have sleeping and staying awake. You have two strategies. Okay, so let's say we have two players. Okay, one is either sleeps or stays awake, and then the other one is, you know, throw a shock, stands there, or leaves the room. Okay, so one person has three strategies, and the other person has two strategies. Okay, so SK is the set of my strategies. So I could throw shock, talk, or leave the room. Okay, and then you guys have to sit, fall asleep, and leave the room, and then now you've got three strategies. Okay, and each player, in principle, can, you know, be choosing from a different set of strategies. Okay, and again, this is like sort of the seller and the buyer. The buyer can, you know, have two different prices, and there's the higher price and lower price, and the buyer can, you know, buy it or not buy it, or buy the higher price, lower price, or nothing. Okay, and so each person has his own set of strategies. Okay, and so the strategy vector is like for each player, they pick a vector, you know, they pick a strategy out of the set of their available ones. Now, and I think all the games I'm going to do again, just because the thing can become arbitrarily complicated very simply, really quickly. I mean, I'm going to have it where the players are, you know, flipping coins and they each flip the same coin, or you play rock, paper, scissors, and, you know, it's the strategy vector is the same for every player. But it's very easy to do games where that's not true. Okay, well, and actually, we'll do some games where it's not true. Okay, and then there are payoffs. Okay. Okay, and so then there's a thing, there's a, for each set of these strategies, the strategy profile, then you have a function, which is usually called pi, which maps the strategy profile into the payoffs for each player. Okay, and that's how the game is specified. So this thing is usually what you write down. So we don't really care what strategies actually consist of. We say that, you know, if you pick strategy one, your payoff is, if you pick strategy one and he picks strategy one, you get a certain payoff. You pick strategy two and he picks strategy one. So then there's this giant matrix, okay, which is called payoff function. Okay, so I'm out of time, and so I'll just finish next time. Okay, but again, it's this completely well-defined mathematical formulation of the very simple things. But, you know, again, you can do it more arbitrary. But again, I'm just going to do simple ones, because as I said, oh, I have these really elementary things. I realize I have several lectures of very elementary concepts. Now, everybody, this is new to everyone. I'm sort of assuming that everybody knows this. Okay. All right. So then you should keep stopping me. All right. Because the whole goal is I'm going to not cover everything, but do it slowly enough, hopefully, that you feel like you know what it's about. Okay.
Do you know the name of that population biologist? The name of that population biologist?
Oh, the guy's name is Maynard Smith.
Oh. Does he work at University of Michigan? Something.
Yeah. I mean, it's very famous. I mean, all of this is very famous. But it's from the 70s, so I should know, but I don't know.
So steady state means like populations remain constant. Okay, so in practice, this never happens, really. Like,
well, it's not that it never happens, but again, if you then look and say what are the mathematical conditions for proving that it will happen, they're extremely restrictive. And then if you go and look at specific models, then it turns out that, you know, there are many, many specific models that never
people use. Like Voltaire models. So.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. You know, and it's